Hello and welcome to the front page. There are just 8 days to go until the Cheltenham Festival gets underway, and after months of debate and discussion, clues and conundrums, we are ready, almost ready, for the extravaganza that is the Cheltenham Festival at Prestbury Park. We are going to be discussing all the big stories leading in to the best 4 days in sport on today's show, and I'm delighted to be joined by Maddie Pleo, first of all. Welcome, Maddie. Are you captivated by Cheltenham Fever?
Yes, very much so. Looking forward to going, looking forward to being there. Hopefully, I've actually had quite a good run of tips recently, so I'm hoping the form is turning just in time for Cheltenham, and looking forward to catching up with a lot of people and enjoying top class action.
Brilliant. And the reference to tipping there is guaranteed that I'm going to come to you for as the only qualified tipster on this show today. Not that I mean to offend you, Deputy Industry Editor Peter Scargill. I'm sure you've been known to tip a winner. Is that the case?
It would be news to me.
Ah, okay. But you're captivated by Cheltenham excitement as well, I assume.
Sure. You know, it's the whole purpose, frankly, of the winter, whatever we may say. People still target their horse to Cheltenham. People still want to be involved at Cheltenham. And yes, the talking can soon stop and the action can soon take place, which is what we all want, really, isn't it?
Well, don't say that at the start of the show, which is going to be dedicated to talking about Cheltenham. There's plenty still to discuss about the festival. And indeed, if you are getting excited for the week's action and beginning to think about your bets and how you're going to attack the festival, then you must get a copy of the Ultimate Guide, which is in all good newsagents now. 104 pages, absolutely packed with tips and insight, interviews, selections from our best minds and those from outside the racing post across the sport. It's a fantastic read and will get you absolutely ready for Tuesday week. The only place we can start our discussion of the Cheltenham Festival is today's breaking news that Constitution Hill has been ruled out of the Cheltenham Festival and will not contest the Champion Hurdle. Maddie, a massive blow. He is the poster boy of jumps racing.
Absolutely. One of the most eagerly anticipated races of the season. The Champion Hurdle is now going to be down to State Man and those who take him on. It's been a difficult time for Constitution Hill and his connections, and that's not just over the last week or so since that deplorable gallop at Kempton Park last Tuesday. Of course, early on in the season, he missed the Fighting Fifth and then he was ruled out of the Unibet Hurdle with a dirty scope. So it's interesting, although these seem to be just small, everyday almost issues that happen in stable yards up and down the country, that now he's missed two intended targets, three through weather and abandonments. What does this mean now for his legacy and the rest of his season? Because this is a substantial period of time that we haven't seen him. And it just proves that, you know, designing your whole career or your whole season around one race can be turned upside down just like that. It's going to be a huge shame, but equally, it makes it an interesting contest with him no longer in the race as well.
Yeah, I mean, there will be people who sort of point at this and say, you know, you've got to be more adventurous campaigning the horse. This is the danger. You only get one run. I think there's a huge dollop of bad luck involved here as well, so I'm hesitant to be too critical of connections and the running plans. But it really just does hammer home when you have a horse of this ability with this much hype around it and this much anticipation, and it only appears once in a season, unless we may hopefully see Constitution Hill later in the season. But if you only see him once, it is just, you know, that's not really going to sell a sport, is it?
No, it's not. But I do think at the same time, it hammers home just how much pressure there are on these horses and the connections of them these days. Nicky Henderson, to be fair to him, has been absolutely brilliant keeping the press and the public updated with this horse every step of the way since that gallop last week. And I think I speak for everyone when I say how appreciated that is. But it's a lot of stress he would have been under in that time, you know, being the custodian of this great superstar. Fingers crossed we get to see him on track. And I think what you said, a point about making the most of these horses when we have them, it's actually a really apt conversation to have, given, of course, that we lost Mark Bradstock last week, who trained Coney Gree, the first novice to win the Gold Cup in an awful long time. And that was a brilliant example of taking the bull by the horns, you know, showing confidence, showing sportsmanship and running your horse and it paying off in majestic style. Thinking of his family at this time and rest in peace very much to Mark Bradstock. But hopefully we're still going to have an excellent Cheltenham Festival and Constitution Hill is still a superstar. Even though he's not ran here, State Man is a superstar and maybe he'll have his big crowning moment at the festival now.
Well, State Man is basically as short as Constitution Hill was before. So we've traded one dominant odds-on favourite for another. Pete, you're a famous cynic. What do you think would have happened if the Constitution Hill gallop had happened in private?
Well, ultimately, you'd have got the same result, perhaps with less rigorous updating of the public, because obviously the issue, if it's the right term for connections, was that everyone was there to see it, this routine piece of work, as we all expected. So the fact that everyone saw it and was able to react to it probably put an extra element of transparency on it, which is good. Because, you know, around the international hurdle that he was due to run in, there was a level of transparency, but it wasn't the same, was it? So I think to some extent it helps, probably helps Henderson with the narrative that's been the season of him dodging targets and not wanting to run the horse. Well, at least everyone saw quite how deplorably that horse worked. I mean, Nicola de Boinville was asked to describe what it was like. He said that, you know, it was like driving your car and you stick your foot down on the accelerator and you get no power. Now, I know exactly how that feels because I'm not joining you in the studio today because I was due to drive down to see you. I pulled my car out, ready to go past the car in front of me, and had a complete power cut and ended up on the side of the road. So I understand where it is. It's a very unfortunate position to be in. But, you know, Constitution Hill, he's got a cold, essentially.
A majestic segue there, Pete. A majestic segue. Let's move on, though, to the clashes that are going to happen. We're not going to see Constitution Hill. It's a great shame. But we are going to see some fantastic races at Cheltenham next week. Pete, what one race is the one you're most looking forward to?
Sort of oddly, because it's not one of the headline races, but I'm really looking forward to the Mayor's Novices Hurdle, because you've got Brighter Days Ahead, which is, you know, she's being talked about as one of the finest horses that Gordon Elliott's ever had, full stop. Then you've got Jade DeGrugy, who was incredibly impressive for Willie Mullins last time, and then Dysart Enos for Virgil O'Brien and Paddy Brennan, will be his last big winner before he retires. So I think that's going to be a cracking race if they all get there, given it's, you know, just over a week before it. We can't be certain they will do, but why do they do? I think that's going to be a cracking race. What about you?
I think I'm looking forward to seeing Gordon Elliott's horse because, as you say, she's been talked up as the sort of second coming. So to see if she lives up to the hype, I think she's 6-4 now, so very short. But for me, it's always about the Gold Cup, I have to be honest. I am just a sucker for the Gold Cup, Maddie. And it looks actually like a vintage running. We have Galopin Deschamps, who is potentially, well, we know he's a superstar, but if he wins this, he would really sort of enter that sort of pantheon of great Gold Cup winners, you would imagine. Fast or Slow, who's resuming rivalry after some really compelling clashes, stands at 2-2 between the two of them. And then interesting horses like Shishkin, the Enigma, Brave Man's Game, who Paul Nicholls is talking up. Hewick. I mean, this is a race that is awash with storylines.
Yeah, that's exactly what you want selfishly as a journalist when you're covering this race and as a fan, I think. You know, those storylines are what get people involved in the sport and passionate about it, and I can't wait for it. One thing I'll say is the one race that I'm looking forward to, probably a bit out there in terms of a selection, is the cross country. And you could argue that the cross country's gain is the Gold Cup's loss, in that, you know, you've got former winner in there, Manella Indo, going for the cross country. Delta Work ran well in the Gold Cup, didn't he, as well? I really like Coco Beach. I think he could upset the two big ones if Gordon Elliott runs him as well, and then he's got Conflated in there. I think that could be a really classy race. And although it's no longer a handicap, which, you know, people are saying that it should be made back into one, I'm not sure I disagree, to be honest. I think it would make it fascinating, and it would ensure a more even playing field when you are getting these ex-Gold Cup types in there. It's going to be a classy race. You're talking about some really high quality stayers. And I think Coco Beach, yeah, he's been underestimated. He's been a really cracking horse throughout the whole of his career, and seemed to take to the banks, the cross-country style fences really well when we last saw him, producing a really strong RPR. So I'm looking forward to seeing the grey take on some of the really classy Gold Cup calibre horses in the cross-country.
Yeah, the cross-country has thrown up some great stories over recent years. Another race that features a surprising champion of old is the Stayers Hurdle, with Noble Yates running in it. Another piece of imaginative training and plotting by Emmett Mullins. It looks a fantastic race as well. I mean, of all the championship races, it's the most wide open. You've got that cohort of sort of veterans, including Paisley Park, and then you've got the young guard, including Fergal O'Brien's great Festival Hope, who are gunning to take them down. That looks a fantastic race.
It does. Often it's a race where people say, oh, this is wide open, and people don't seem to like that for some reason, but I do, because that's what makes a contest fascinating from a punting perspective, if you can nail your colours to the mast. And sometimes we don't like the expected. You know, we know these days that the Cheltenham Festival is full of odds on favourites and short prices more so than ever before. I'd love to see Paisley Park run a cracking race. It would be a huge ask. And equally, when we're talking of running plans, that'll segue hopefully into another section. Flooring Porter, is he going to come back and try and regain his crown, or is he going to go for the National Hunt Chase? So still so many tantalising questions to be asked. But it's building up nicely, that race.
Certainly is. We're going to come back to those key running plans in just a second. Well, one last question I want to pose to both of you. We have a lot of short price favourites this year's festival. If you were taking on one, which would it be and why?
Oh, that's hard to do off the cuff. I do wonder whether El Fabiola's jumping will catch him out at some point. He's clearly the classiest horse in that race, and John Bond's jumping isn't foolproof, as we saw in the Clarence House either. But I just think his technique is not without flaw. So maybe him.
I looked it up, his form earlier, because I'm exactly with you. I'm on El Fabiola just at 1-2, given his history of slightly ropey jumping. You know, if you look at his last four races, every single one, you know, there are not fluent jumps, or there are outright mistakes in there. And you just think, I mean, on one hand, incredible testament that he's been able to rack up such a dominant series of wins despite that. However, is it going to get found out one of these days? And if so, the champion chase at Cheltenham.
Particularly if Edward Stone adopts his new front-running tactics and blazes off out in front, that sort of pace pressure can really turn a horse on his head. So hopefully, we want to see El Fabiola produce his best, but at the prices, I would not be backing him.
Pete, you've had an extra 30 seconds to think about this question. Which shorty are you taking on?
Yeah, all the time was greatly appreciated. Thank you. He's not as short as El Fabiola, but you've got to take on Marine Nationale, haven't you, in the Arful. He was very good first time. He was absolutely dreadful the last time. Now, obviously, Barry Connell quoted in the paper talking about saying that he's still a brilliant horse. Don't worry about it. As long as it's not soft, he's going to win. But he was just so awful last time. And I know the likes of Paul Keeley were incredibly sceptical. And indeed, Tom Siegel was very sceptical of his prospects.
Barry Connell told us last year, he told everyone who would listen, Marine Nationale was going to win. And he did. And now it's so easily forgotten. Barry Connell told us, I'm keeping the faith. I'm keeping the faith. I think he's a good price now.
I was described as a noted cynic by someone earlier in this program. I'm only living up to my reputation.
That is so true. And we need that balance on this show. Thank you, Pete.
I'm with Pete, by the way. Found a 50, I think, for me. Yeah, can't have Marie Nationale. So there you go, Pete. There's some confidence.
Excellent. Let's turn to running plans. There's still a few up in the air, as ever, Maddie. I guess Barry Byrne's a big one.
Yeah, he's the pivotal one. Over the last couple of days, murmurs and the betting's indicated that he's shortening for the Barring Bingham on the Wednesday rather than the Supreme on the Tuesday. There's been some movement for Mystical Power as well. Obviously, these things all have knock-on impacts, but he's in so many different multiples and, you know, he's a very short-priced favourite for both races. So it's going to be the pinnacle decision which race he goes for. I've said before why I think he should go for the Supreme. If he was mine, I'd run him in the Supreme. But when you're Willie Mullins and you've got as much strength in depth, it probably makes sense to go for the longer distance race. But we know how we get these market cues and then they prove to be all wrong. So we can't make our decisions just yet on which race we definitely think he's going to go for, because we don't know. And neither will Willie Mullins probably until just before the race. So
yeah, there's a lot of people sort of scrutinising the exchanges or comments of Patrick Mullins. I think Patrick Mullins, you know, this sort of sums up, Patrick Mullins will be the first to say, I don't have a clue where they're going to run, you know.
It does bring in the question, should we have the earlier decks or at least have a stage whereby connections have to outline their first preference, though? Because when it comes to, punting and, you know, money being wagered on these races and having established fields and established markets that people can really digest and get stuck into, relatively, we don't have that long. And, you know, who's to say it wouldn't be a massive net plus for the game if we were to have these outlined fields way before we do. But others would argue that it adds to the intrigue as well. I'm not so sure myself.
I think this week in particular is such a key week where the excitement really reaches fever point. Lots of people, including like myself, who don't really dabble in antipost markets a long way out from races, start to look at them in earnest and think about getting some early bets on. If there was more definitive shape to some of the key races, I can only imagine that's got to be good for Cheltenham.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it takes a lot of the guesswork out of the occasion. Some people like that sort of thing. But if you're talking about how much money's going to be wagered on a race and how appealing it's going to look, the longer punters have to get their teeth stuck into it, as you're saying, surely the better. So I don't know. What do you think? Do you think it could happen in future? Do you think changes could be made so that trainers have to, either we get even earlier declarations or trainers have to decide which race they're going to go for, their number one choice?
I don't know if it will happen. It's not an issue which I have considered the technical challenges to doing that or the political challenges. I think on a logical basis, it makes a lot of sense. One thing I would like to see coming out of this festival is a sort of holistic review of the festival, because while I think it remains the best week in jumps racing, perhaps the best week in sport, there's clearly some issues, some areas around competitiveness, around the cost of going racing, around the race day experience that I think could be improved. And I would love to see the Jockey Club sit down with a range of industry stakeholders, as they're known, and sort of assess, well, how can we make this better? I think there's a few races that you'd maybe get rid of. And I think there's some sort of technical changes you could make like that would add to the build up. I would like to see that, but I have no idea. I'm not basing that on any conversations that will happen. I would love to see that happen.
Yeah, agree. That would be good just to get an overriding picture of, you know, and as well, I think it's good for race goers and punters to actually feel like they're being listened to as well. We spoke earlier about the slow ticket sales, for instance, and the cost of going racing, but also, you know, the general enthusiasm for the sport, given the number of races, the competitiveness, the Irish dominance, you know, handicapping issues like that. It would just be great to have a sort of response from the race course about how they are taking on board people's concerns in these different areas.
And Pete, one of the angles that will be scrutinised a great deal next week and indeed after the festival is almost certainly going to be the dominance of the Irish over the British, or perhaps more accurately, the dominance of Willie Mullins over everyone else. So we will not know until after the week just how dominant Willie Mullins has been. You can go through the race cars and you can see what an extraordinary array of favourites he has. So he clearly could have an extraordinary haul. He could hit double figures and absolutely clean up. However, equally, a few things go wrong and it's a more modest tally. But one thing we can definitely say for certain is that on entries alone, Ireland is in an extremely strong position. And indeed, last week we revealed that for the first time ever, 52%, a majority of Cheltenham entries came from Ireland, which is an extraordinary change of division compared to just a few years ago.
It is. It was a remarkable piece that Stuart Riley wrote. Also, the fact that he said the percentage of Irish runners had gone up from 25% roughly in 2011 to 52% this year. So, I mean, it's not even that. It's just over a decade, isn't it, that they've doubled the amount of entries they have. So, I mean, obviously, there's a multiple reasons for this in terms of, now, are fewer trainers going to Cheltenham because they're looking at Aintree, and the centralisation of powers in certain yards means that perhaps you don't get as much of a spread. But look, sport is fantastic because it is often unpredictable, and that's why people watch things. That's why, you know, there's so much emphasis on live sports and making sure that people watch it live, because it's one of the few things in life, theoretically, that is so unpredictable. So, Willie Mullins has got 13 favourites on my counting. That's just nearly half the races. He's 1-7 to be top trainer. He is 2-5 to have 8 or more winners. So, you know, all those numbers show you where he is, and are highly likely that he's going to have loads of winners. He will need to have a fast start, as he so often likes to have, because Thursday in particular looks sort of a weakish day for him. But, you know, if he's smashed in 4 winners on the first day, then goodness knows where he is. 10's his maximum. He's going to be getting up towards. I think Robbie Wilders did a piece saying that the 8.5 winners was roughly what he should be getting on the form book. So, you know, it's going to be up towards 10, isn't it, realistically?
And how about these for horses that aren't going to be running at the meeting that could have been? Aloho, Grange, Clare West, Appreciate It, Blue Lord, Champ Kylie, The Nice Guy, Maureen, Indiana Dream, etc., etc. Good few of them would probably be favourites for individual races.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. He's actually been relatively unlucky with setbacks and injuries, keeping some of those stable stars out. Imagine with a fair wind, what it could have been like. Maddie, one of the things I thought was very interesting about the analysis that Stuart did was how it showed actually the bigger factor isn't an increase in absolute terms in Irish entries. That's actually remained fairly steady, at least for the last few years, but rather a complete collapse in the number of British entries, falling from 1,082 in 2020 to 599.
Were you surprised by that?
I suppose I wasn't surprised, because we knew that that is the story that has been underpinning a lot of what's happening. It's a weakness in Britain. It's a decision for some trainers and owners to prioritise other festivals, Paul Nicholls most notably, a decline perhaps in what was known as social runners. But I think still seeing it spelled out so starkly. I mean, you know, you're talking a 40% drop in entries from Britain. That's pretty extraordinary.
It is. It didn't surprise me, though. We know that these are wider themes we've spoken about on this show for many, many weeks. Some people say that it doesn't really concern them where horses are trained. And maybe this is just, you know, I'm not a particularly patriotic person, but I do think it's slightly sad when you can't see British runners compete in the way that they once used to. Of course, that's being addressed through the handicap system. There was an overhaul, there was a review of all of that, and that seems to have gone down pretty well. As someone who likes the romantic stories at big days like the festival, I mean, spoke earlier about Mark Bradstock, Coney Gree, what a great achievement that was and what a great result. I'd love to see more of those, because I think that's really what gets people interested in the sport and reminds us that, you know, it's achievable for, you know, some of us lowly people who, you know, don't have the great power and money of some of these big superpowers. But at the same time, you can't ignore what they've achieved and how dominant they've become. I think for me, one thing that interests me when it comes to this Irish dominance, and particularly when we're thinking about how it's going to change and how Britain are then going to challenge again and try and reaffirm their position, is if you look at the grassroots, how many of the top sires, national hunt-wise, stand in Britain? Mm. Very few of them. If you look at the difference between our point-to-point fields, no disrespect, some excellent point-to-point trainers we have in this country, and Ireland's, couldn't be more different. you know, the structure of racing in Ireland has developed, and you're having these incredibly professional, thorough outfits producing these top horses who come from the top pedigrees because they've got better access to those sires immediately on that side of the Irish Sea. Whereas over here, we don't really have that. So that's an area that I think if Britain could invest much more into the grassroots and the lower levels, I think that's a way that we can compete. But without attracting those owners who want the superior prize money in Ireland, I wonder how that's going to happen.
It's a really good point about this sort of grassroots and breeding landscape. I guess the other factor there, though, is actually the rise of French breeds.
Yeah.
Because actually, Britain sort of is almost a non-player in that battle. And the French breeds have actually streaked ahead of Ireland in terms of being responsible for the top 50 highest rated
And you look
horses.
At someone like Paul Nicholls, who had, you know, first dibs, I guess, on that section of horses, you know, with Corto Star, with Big Bucks, so many of those good French horses, can't think of their names off the top of my head. But I think now, and this is one reason why Willie Mullins is particularly dominant, is he has the personnel on the ground. And not only does he have the access to these pools of horses through his powerful owners, who are of course willing to pay more money than anyone else because they know that he can get the job done and he's incredibly proficient at producing excellent top quality horses, he's just got the monopoly on people as well, and he knows the right people, he's got the right agents working for him, and he's just ruthlessly efficient when it comes to the racing industry as a whole. You know, things that normal people might not consider when they look at Cheltenham, you know, when it comes to sourcing these horses on the ground, no matter where they're from, whether they're from France, Britain, some of his really good horses have come from bizarre backgrounds. You know, you look at the likes of Underso, Energamine by Unheralded Sires, some of them haven't cost an awful lot of money either. So to me, that just points towards him being incredibly experienced, but also when you're part of such a big team as he is, you need to have the people around you to rely on. And when you've got Patrick Mullins, Ruby Walsh, David Casey as well on the ground physically working with these two horses, you've got outstanding staff, everything just falls into place. And that's clearly what he's done. He has orchestrated this unbeatable team.
We can't leave Cheltenham, Maddie, without talking about the weather. The going at Cheltenham is soft, heavy in places. Very, very wet winter, wettest February on record, I think I read, in some parts of the country, more than 100 millimetres of rain at Cheltenham. But this week is quite dry. A few showers about today, maybe a few showers at the weekend. How do we think it's going to ride?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we have had so much rain. But if you look at the long range forecast, it's actually not too bad. Now, the betting says typically it's going to be good to soft, which is what we're used to seeing on the opening day of Cheltenham. You know, there's so much contention around it, but invariably we end up with good to soft. That is 4-6, soft is 5-4, and heavy is 8-1. I think it's easy, because we've had so much rain in this part of the country, to think, oh, it's definitely going to be heavy, it's definitely going to be testing conditions. But with the dry weather seemingly incoming, we'll see how the forecast plays out. It might not be too bad.
It's a bit warmer now as well, so it does dry out quite quickly. I think when the sun's out, you get a few dry days.
And fingers crossed there's no risk of frost or anything like that either. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of days, but it invariably rides a bit more testing on that first day as well, doesn't it? Obviously, fresh ground that's not been raced on yet, and it dries out through the week. But yeah, I checked the forecast, due to be in attendance, and fingers crossed it stays dry for all of us going anyway.
Absolutely. That's everything on the Cheltenham Festival for this week, but we will be back to talk about the Cheltenham Festival after the festival itself. No show next Monday, but we'll be back the following Monday, when there'll be a special show hosted by Maddie. I hope that's not news.
No, it's not. It's not. I just forgot.
With Paul Keeley and lots of other experts in attendance. So please do tune in then. We are going to touch on two other stories very quickly before we wrap up today, because it's been such a busy racing week, we thought we couldn't leave you without a little bit of analysis on them. The first concerns the parliamentary debate on affordability checks, which took place in Westminster Hall last Monday. The debate, which is prompted by the petition against Jecks reaching over 100,000 signatures, was well attended by MPs. Numerous MPs turned out to raise concerns about the impact on Jecks, on racing and on betting and betting customers. But I think it's fair to say that the government response provided by Gambling Minister Stuart Andrew left many of racing supporters and those within the sport disappointed, as he appeared to read out a largely pre-written statement which simply rehearsed the existing government line. Pete, what was your take on the debate? You, of course, watched every minute of it.
Yeah, it was a very well-attended debate by all accounts for a Westminster Hall debate. So I think the push to get people there was helpful in that regard. Because, you know, obviously this is an opportunity to spell out to government what the concerns are directly. That was, you know, that's the point of the debate. So, I mean, there are issues raised very forcefully, particularly by, you know, racing-friendly or racing-supportive MPs such as Philip Davis and George Freeman, who I know you spoke to in advance, Conor McGinn, Lawrence Robertson, all spoke extremely well to put the point across. But like you say, there was a great deal of frustration. And Lawrence Robertson, I spoke to him afterwards, and he is going to sort of bring together a group of backbench MPs and go directly to the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, because he feels that there's some sort of block in place. He kept saying that he understood the position of Stuart Andrew and of Lucy Fraser, who's the Culture Secretary, says he always finds them very good to deal with. But for whatever reason, he feels there's a block higher up, so therefore he has to take it higher up. So whilst it wasn't necessarily the outcome that people might have wanted because Stuart Andrew read from a rehearsed script, there clearly isn't a desire to let this go away. And that's quite right, because this remains obviously one of, if not the most important issue facing racing and punters. So they need to push on, and pushing on to the Prime Minister, well, you can't go any higher, can you?
Well, perhaps the Prime Minister for now, but then the question is for how long? There was a poll today where the Tories are on 20%, an absolutely dismal performance, which suggests that Labour are heading for a absolutely barnstorming landslide. No doubt their performance will improve slightly by the time an election is held later this year. But given the likelihood of a Labour government incoming this year, the response of the shadow gambling minister, Steph Peacock, was particularly notable. What did you make of that, Pete?
Yes, there was an argument put forward within the debate about how racing should be considered, you know, betting on horse racing should be considered separately. It was put forward by Matt Hancock in particular. And Stephanie Peacock was sort of keen to group everything together. And obviously there were contributions within the debate from Paul Blomfield and from Carolyn Harris, who are both Labour MPs, who were both, you know, very much in a position of saying these checks need to come in and they're very important. There were very few Labour MPs in the debate. Conor McGinn, who was elected as a Labour MP but sits an independent, was the only Labour elected MP to sort of speak in racing's favour. And that's a troubling aspect of it, isn't it? You know, you've got this, all of the indicators to say we're going to get a Labour government that speaks from a Labour position isn't speaking in a way that racing will be particularly pleased to hear. I mean, that's my takeaway from it. Tom, obviously, you have these discussions as well. I don't know if there's anything that you've picked up from your chats that would give any other hope.
I think the only thing to add to that is that Steph Peacock did highlight in her response to the minister the importance of ensuring that the checks were truly frictionless, and raising the risk that if they were not, that would have unforeseen consequences, including potentially fueling the black market. So it's encouraging to see Labour taking some note of the importance of getting regulation right, or at least considering that there may be unwanted consequences to otherwise well-meaning initiatives. And that, you know, obviously follows on from our recent coverage of the black market. We, of course, spoke last week about an illegal operator that was looking for business in racing circles. It was encouraging in that respect to see the Gambling Commission Chief Executive Andrew Rhodes acknowledge, I think for the first time midweek, that the black market was a concern and that the Gambling Commission was actively investigating a number of leads, having of course previously downplayed the black market, suggested it wasn't really a big deal, it was very, very small in this country, and suggesting that nobody had ever given him a single example of a black market operator.
Well, precisely that. And, you know, by all accounts, the operator that was exposed by Lee and by the coverage is no longer operating. And it's always been something that's been dismissed and, you know, put forward by the Gambling Commission that people are worrying and, you know, sort of distracting from the issue. But clearly it is an issue. Clearly it's an issue that's only going to grow with things as they stand. So it's good that the Gambling Commission have woken up to it, but, you know, there needs to be proper affirmative action.
I also thought it was encouraging that Andrew Rhodes acknowledged that by their very nature, these black market bookies are difficult to find. And he sort of referenced, well, if people aren't telling him about them, which they're probably not likely unless they're losing money or not receiving money, then he's not going to know about them. And I thought that was a very key distinction to make, particularly when we know that many of these people are operating through WhatsApp, for instance. You know, they're not regulated. And it's just a totally underground sort of operation that can very much take place quietly. And as we saw in the case with that Lee exposed, almost shamelessly. Mm. So I thought that was a key acknowledgement from him that I was glad to hear.
And I think the most important thing on this subject and the thing to close with is the importance of emphasising why these black market operators exist. And the reasons they exist is because there's a demand for them created by a combination of affordability checks and other restrictions, which mean people cannot get on their bets with regulated operators. Given a choice, nobody wants to go to a black market operator. You have no security whatsoever. But the regulation and operation of the betting industry has created this reality.
Yeah, and that's something that Sean Trivis referenced, chair of the HBF, of course. Great that we're hearing his voices and even still to now punters' experiences about not just affordability checks, but being restricted and treatment from different bookmakers. And as you say, Tom, if there is a demand, then people will find ways to bet.
Our final story that we're going to touch on this week concerns news out of Newmarket that the stables of Saeed bin Sarur, Godolphin's long-standing trainer, are being downsized. A number of redundancies are going to be carried out there. This follows a quiet few years for Saeed bin Sarur, who has far, far fewer runners than he did in the past, since the rise and rise of Charlie Appleby, his colleague at Godolphin. Maddie, it's been a curious one. Obviously, Saeed had a classic winner last year, but at the same time, he had a very quiet year, 18 winners from 105 runners, his poorest return in Britain since 2000.
Yeah, remarkable really for a trainer that is so decorated and long-standing in British racing for his performance to plummet in such a way. But the simple facts are that he doesn't appear to be receiving the same raw materials as he once did. As you say, that coincides with Charlie Appleby really emerging as the surefire number one trainer for Godolphin. But it's sad to see Saeed, you know, a trainer who we know and we saw last year with Morge winning the Guineas. He was a bit unfortunate with her as well, of course, because she was injured after that success. No longer be able to compete regularly on the big days. You know, I'm sure streamlining is something that Godolphin do regularly, but this was a little bit of a shock to me that they would, you know, enter this redundancy process at his stables. Hugh Anderson sort of said, well, you know, Saeed will still be operating, which is great to hear. But equally, it's further evidence of a shift going on at Godolphin and changes within their operation.
And Bintaro has had an incredibly quiet Dubai Carnival as well.
Absolutely dominated by Charlie Appleby. I think he's won 9 out of the 10 turf pattern races. That was prior to Super Saturday. I wrote about that in a preview for the meeting. And a remarkable winner he had with Cinderella's Dream, wasn't it, with William Buick losing his irons. Seems to be as dominant as ever. Bold Act, another big winner for him on Saturday. There's certainly a change in direction at Godolphin, but we've been seeing it go that way for some time now.
And Pete, you're a born and bred in Newmarket, so you know how hugely important to that town Godolphin is. I think anything like this happens with Godolphin, there's a degree of sort of reading the runes going on about what's happening with Godolphin, what's happening with Sheikh Mohammed. He, of course, doesn't really go racing in Britain anymore. He's not even seen as often at the races in Maidan. That, on the other hand, he was at TATS last year. What are you hearing and what are people saying on the ground?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, Newmarket's growth over the last 40, 50 years has been fueled by money from the Middle East and a lot of it from the Maktoum family. So whenever anything happens with Godolphin, it, you know, Newmarket gets jittery, frankly. So look, it is obviously got far fewer horses, only 41 horses listed in training on the BHA website compared to 143 that Charlie Appleby has. And this just feeds into a sort of a narrative of, for want of a better term, rationalisation by Godolphin. So they've leased out Highfield Stables, which was formerly Saeed's overflow yard. So Harry Eustace has gone in there. That's a first for them. They are in the process of selling Craven House and Shadowfax Stables on Racecourse Side. That's still under offer at the moment. But, you know, that was a big operation. That was part of Darley pre-training, which is no longer there. They have no second jockey now at Charlie Appleby's because James Doyle has gone as well. So, and David Mills wrote a postcard from Newmarket in January talking about Warren Place, which has been empty since 2015, and almost hinting that now that Highfield's been leased out, perhaps something similar would happen there. So the worry, if that's the right term, is that if someone like Sheikh Mohammed, who's poured untold millions, billions probably, into horse racing in Britain over the last however many years, is rationalising what sort of position he's going to be in. You know, if they're contracting, that is troubling in terms of Newmarket stableness. But then at the same time, if you go off the back of a small group of people, you're going to put yourself in this position. So perhaps people will be taking this as an opportunity to expand their base somewhat.
Thanks, Pete. That story was originally an exclusive for Racing Post Members Club Ultimate subscribers. If you want to get free access to our Members Club Ultimate offering, you can do so for just a couple of days left on the Racing Post app, where we're running a free access event that gives you access to all of our premium tipping, our news reporting, our opinion and features work, as well as race analysis and race replay. So download the app, create a Racing Post account, and you can sample it all for the next few days. Don't miss out on that. That's all we've got time for this week. But my thanks to Maddie and to Pete for joining me. My thanks to you at home for joining as well. And do remember to tune in again to all of the Racing Post YouTube shows over the Cheltenham Festival, and then on the Monday following the festival for a deep dive into everything that happened at Prestbury Park. In the meantime, enjoy the festival and happy punting.